Howdy, folks. Welcome back to Down with the Dharma podcast. Today, Carl Stamer is back, and we are going to talk about a book called On Killing by Dave Grossman, who's a former Army Ranger and psychology professor at West Point. This book is widely used for people in the military as well as people in police training. And so there's a lot of really interesting stuff in the book, and then there's also stuff that's problematic about it, but it relates to our overall discussion that we've been doing on this podcast of using the Buddhist teaching on dependent origination to understand human behavior and how to cultivate positive behavior patterns, how to heal or transform trauma and addiction that might cause negative behavior patterns. This book it's got a lot of core stuff in it. For the folks at home, if you hadn't heard the previous podcasts where we had Carl on the show, Carl is a friend of mine that we met at Deer Park Monastery when I was a monk there, and Carl was living in Encinitas with his wife Avan and his son Sage. Actually one of the first conversations we had was about this book. So Carl is a former Marine. He was in the Force Recon Unit. He served in the War on Drugs, as well as the first Desert Storm, but then he became a conscientious objector and was able to successfully leave the Marines. Do you remember, Carl? Like, I can remember we had that conversation. I think we were outside in Solidity Hamlet, like, I think outside the office, like on a bench.
Absolutely. That's exactly where we were. Yep.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of our first real conversations.
Yeah. And I can't even remember how I found this book. I don't even know how I found it, but I was like reading it. I'm like, oh my God, this is like incredible. I feel like I'm really learning a lot here. And then like, you were the first person who was like, yeah, I feel the same way. And then we had this like deep conversation about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great book, right?
Yeah.
It's an interesting topic of conversation because, and this will come up as you talk more about the book, but I'm kind of amazed at how that it is such a tool for the military and police.
Mm-hmm.
Because from where I sit now, when I read it, what I see is all of the points of resistance to violence that sort of our natural inclination to not be violent being, you know, brought to the front, right, and talked about. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it seems just as much as a tool for nonviolence as for the perpetuation of. And I think that's actually one of the things that makes the really interesting text.
Yeah, so it's this weird, it's almost kind of like a schizophrenic feeling, like, wow, there's all this amazing stuff of how humans have this innate resistance to killing, and there's a way of understanding the process of how killing happens, and then it's like so close but so far, like,
yep.
he like develops this amazing analysis that could be used to prevent killing and be like a force for good in the world, but it's like it's just like left unused.
Yeah, it gets to the sort of denouement of the story and then takes a different turn than where you and I would go.
Yeah.
With the exact same evidentiary base.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what the?
Yeah. I think because it has a purpose, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is important to know that it's not so much a pure scholarly thesis, right? It's not setting out to understand the nature of killing for it from an intellectual point of view for its own sake, to come to understanding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's reason for being is to understand a thing quite particularly so that we can intervene behaviorally in the training of people to accomplish, to become better killers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it exists, right? And that's the troubling part, but he did some really good research.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
In its quest to accomplish that goal.
Yeah. It's almost like, you think of like the scientists that created the nuclear bomb, like they were studying nuclear physics. And it's like this agenda of like creating a bomb to win the war is what drove the project.
Right.
As opposed to just pure curiosity and like the, yeah, with, you know, not having an agenda to use it.
Yeah, let's understand the atom, right?
Yeah. So
I think that's that foregone conclusion that killing is necessary that underlies the whole project.
Right.
Right. And so it doesn't ever step outside of that. It can't escape that foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
It's the invisible bullet of the whole story.
And it's like, so I guess, I mean, it's almost like I share the same, it's almost like he has just this intense curiosity about the process, which of course it is a fascinating topic. So I think a lot of it probably is, he just genuinely wanted to know what this is. And I think that's why I as a reader am so fascinated by it. But then, yeah, there is this weird, like, it's just so obvious how this could be used in a positive way. And it just, he doesn't address that.
Right.
But anyway, okay. So our plan is to kind of go through the main points of the book, and then I'll kind of tee it up. Like, here's the main point. And then because Carl's has experience as a veteran in the military, like he can give us a perspective of it. As well as just obviously someone who also like me has a curious mind and is just curious about it. Like, even if you weren't a veteran. So one of his first main things that he presents in the book is that human beings have an innate resistance to killing, that there's like an instinctual resistance to kill. And so he bases that, there was research done during World War II where they basically like looked at how much ammunition was being used in a given battle. And then like the kill ratio of like how many people actually got killed compared to how many bullets were actually fired. And then they also did interviews of soldiers, like who actually was involved in killing and who was, so basically what they found was like a lot of soldiers were just choosing not to shoot directly at the enemy. They would shoot up in the air or shoot like away from the enemy, or they would do something else besides shooting. They would just be moving ammunition up, or taking care of people that are wounded. And then he did research. Like, he was talking about like the Civil War, like when they looked at these battles, they recreate these battles. It was like two groups of men standing very close to each other, shooting directly at each other. It, like the battle should have been over in basically 5 minutes, but they went on for a longer period of time. So it was like, oh, they must not have actually been shooting directly at each other. They must have been, a lot of them must have been just shooting in the air. And so it took time for the ones that were shooting directly to actually kill all the people that they were going to kill. So that's one of the main points that he brings out. So that's my first question then to you, Carl, is based on your experience being in the military, did you observe that behavior pattern to be true or not? And this also, there's a second point that we'll get into where he talks about the training that soldiers did for World War II compared to the training soldiers did for Vietnam, and they changed the training and that made the kill ratio go up.
So I'll leave that second point.
Yeah.
And I think there's a third point that we're going to get to also eventually that I'll leave aside for now, which is those individuals who actually do enjoy it and are predisposed. Right. And that's an interesting part of it, but I think we're going to address that also as a separate issue. Yeah. So, I mean, I think just the first question, just whether there's a sort of innate resistance to it. And I think that's completely true of my individual experience.
Okay.
You know, and anecdotally, I think of most of the people around me in the Marine Corps. For me personally, and I think this is true, was true for the majority of my peers in the Corps. Mm-hmm. What makes, and I think it is, I always have this caveat, which is that I think that there are some similarities, but also some big differences between the various military services too, right? And so I can only speak to the Marine Corps, you know, which is my experience, which has its own unique edge to it. But for me and most of my peers, the attraction of the Marine Corps is that it, you know, has the reputation of being the most difficult and most uncomfortable service of them all, right? That just gets the dirtiest, worst jobs and, you know, where you're going to get beat on the most and it's just going to be really hard. And for a certain subset of the human population, you know, myself included, and we talked about this more in our other podcast, you know, knowing that I could survive that and wanting to succeed in that environment was a highly attractive endeavor. You know what I mean? Like, that was important to me. So, like, if I was going to join the military, that's where I was going to go. The one where I felt like I was going to have the hardest, most difficult possible challenge. And that was the attraction.
Right.
Not the idea that I was ever actually going to have to kill somebody. And mostly I hoped that was, you know, quite consciously never really going to happen, you know? And when one, even though I, you know, I came through in a training of an era after this book, right? Where they, where things had changed a lot to try to get that out of you. And we'll get to that point. But even in the face of that, for me, and I think most of my peers, there's a sense of, I really hope I never have to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a very weird thing. I remember when Desert Storm was happening, I remember thinking, I really hope I get to go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I hope this is going to happen. I want to be challenged. I want to know what that environment is like.
Yeah.
But I really hope I don't have to kill somebody.
Right.
I don't know how I thought those two things weren't going to go together, you know, right? But the human mind is an amazing thing. But I do think innately, even from the abstract going in, people sort of know, I really hope it doesn't come to that. And I then also know that there's another point where it gets much, now you're in the shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this is really getting real, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the conversation in your head starts to shift to, I don't know if I'll be able to.
Mm. Right.
That's, I think, an important twist of the brain.
Yeah.
Where you start really, really, really sort of going, I don't know that I can do this.
Right.
I know that I can stand there and get shot. I know that I can go. I know I can follow my orders. I know I can do this. But I don't know that I can look another person in the eye and take them down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, turns out I bring up that look a person in the eye is really important because a lot of them, as we move into the training and a lot of the realities of modern warfare are quite consciously designed to make it so that you never actually have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But interestingly, I will say that I do think that there is the point where you become extremely willing to kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, actually is that point where you could see them, look them in the eye.
Mm.
Something shifts in you the moment that you feel very immediately, actively, physically threatened.
Yeah.
Where you really feel like I'm about to engage with this person and one of us is not going to make it out alive, there a new thing happens in your brain that is like, I will survive at all costs. And a lot of that other conversation starts to disappear and you get very reactionary. It's just like, I'm trying to cuss as little as possible. This weird thing happens when I get military, like all the foul language really starts to come out. It's part of the training, you know? where this whole other kind of weird, panicked mental state sets in that can still be very calm, but there is a kind of panic going on in your head where everything just turns to, what do I need to do to survive in this moment?
Yeah.
You pretty much become willing to do anything that you would have to do to survive in those last spaces of like very close physical proximity contact when you literally feel like threatened, I'm going to die in the next 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Something flips, right? And I think this, I think this comes up in the book too. He talks about these sort of different stages of threat and where people kick in.
Yeah,
and I think a lot more people do become willing to do it then in this kind of weird out of body sort of moment where you're just like, I'm just trying, like now I'm like just trying to stay alive. I'm not following an order. I'm not trying to take that hill. I'm not trying to, like, it's this person is going to kill me in the next couple seconds if I don't do something.
Right.
You know, and you will grab whatever is at your disposal, you know, a gun, a rock, a knife, whatever, anything you can possibly do to survive in that moment. Most people will do without conscious intervention. And sort of a, you know, if you, I think for 99% of the people on the planet would all avail themselves of whatever weapon, anything they could in those final seconds.
Yeah.
Without training otherwise. I think you actually have to be, then be trained, you know what I mean? So that you have a mental model of how to behave to not do that, right? Yeah. But that describes like almost none of the real experience of warfare, actually, despite what you see on TV, you know?
Right. That
most of it is all at a distance and, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that those moments are very, 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 very few that they're actually that way.
Yeah. So it's like, when you're saying this overall desire to be in the Marines, because it's like, you want to be tested. I feel like, yeah, there is some just need that human beings have to be challenged and like realize their full potential. Like, it's like, this need for intensity, this need for like, just like survival. Am I strong enough to do this?
Yeah.
But, and it's like, I feel like, you know, as human society has industrialized, become modern and all of that, it's like people don't have that space anymore to engage in something so intensely and deeply. So it's like there's that thing doesn't just go away. There's a need for that. And so then, I mean, we can think like, yeah, like if we just think of how was killing done in tribal cultures, like before industrialization, like warrior energy, I guess, warrior habit energy. So that's like this very strong pull that gets you into the zone where killing could happen. But like you're saying, there's still some kind of denial about that. There's a part of the book where Grossman says like that killing, there's like a pleasure in the actual act of killing. And so it's like, I think because it's like just this survival. Ken Wilbury talks about,
it's the ultimate victory.
Right.
It's undeniable. Like you have won.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, like there's no question. Well, if it had gone this way or if it had gone that, there's no smack talking afterwards.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's very clean actually. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it's hard. There are very, 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 very few analogs in life that have that kind of finality to them.
Yeah.
Where you just walk away and say, all right, I won that one.
Yeah.
You know?
And so this kind of deep biological, Kim Wilber, he talked about like male testosterone. It's basically fuck it or kill it. Like those are the two primal drives. And so then, And then Grossman talks about like killing as being similar to sex. It's like just, it's this powerful, intense experience. And both sex and killing is about survival of the organism, right? It's like genetic survival. And I mean, if you think it goes back to like war also is about like conquering land. It's like, it's this like deep level survival thing going on.
It's, I don't know, man. It's just, it's so complicated, you know, yeah. I mean, because part of me also thinks that, okay, there's a couple things about this. And I mean, not to get too graphic, mm-hmm. you know, about this, but like, okay, let's take sex, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sex is a very long continuum that starts with, you know, you getting your, you know, your privates powered when you're a little baby, and then you touching yourself, and then, you know, you have a whole series of experiences that are analogs leading up that are true analogs and are participating in the same energy, right? Yeah. So before you ever actually literally have sex for procreation, you already have a very strong sense that this is going to be fucking great.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Like you, it, you know, I mean, it's going to feel good, right? And you know that. So it's not just about sort of biological wiring. You actually have a whole slew of experiences mm-hmm. that are bringing you to that place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I submit to you that killing somebody else is actually quite different.
Okay.
There is not the same analog. Like wrestling with somebody is not part of that same experience. There's something very different that goes on in that moment of legitimate true life and death.
Yeah.
I actually think that this is one of our political problems in America. I say problem and I want to take that word back right away, mm-hmm. right? Because one of our realities is that despite the fact that we think we live in a very violent world, in a very violent culture where we're inundated with violence on TV and all of that stuff, I am here to tell you, there is nothing similar about, and I'm not saying it's not bad and it's not problematic, mm-hmm. but there mm-hmm. is nothing similar about the violence you experience on TV or even the threat of violence and the actual violence. Like the experience of truly being physically threatened and attacked, we're like, this is it. Like somebody's not surviving this moment is so fundamentally different from every other experience you have ever had in your life that creates it's hard to theorize about. And I think it really does. The reason I use the word problem, it really affects our culture, the way our politics work and stuff, because this is where veterans do get kind of like a little bit of anger seeps out. They're like, don't talk to me about this. What the fuck could you possibly know? You know? And there's some real truth to that. you know, it's just, there is none. Like, whereas on the sex curve, there is, you can't say, okay, maybe you haven't had sex yet, but you've done this and you've done that. It's just so fundamentally not the same thing that it's weird then any reinforcement of killing because of its pleasurable aspect can only happen once you've actually been there once. Right. And that means you were the killer and not the killed. Right. Because to be there means to have been in that moment, in that situation. And then if you're around to still be theorizing about it, it's because you're the guy that survived. Right. So it's this weird kind of thing that you do sort of cross to this other dimension of experience. And none of the stuff leading you there is it actually is a quantum shift in how you relate to the world. That I think makes it hard actually to, but I do think like the military and part of what this book is doing and stuff is the whole point is to provide situations that encourage people to put themselves in situations where they can get that. Right. You know what I mean? Right. And you know, is to continuously build a warrior class. Right. And I think have you ever read any of MacArthur's writings like after the war?
No.
Really, really interesting. I mean, he died a pacifist, you know, basically.
Right.
And he has these just phenomenal writings that he did. And one of them being like the speech that he gave after, you know, he was sent over and to sort of like liberate the Philippines from the occupation. Mm-hmm. And he gives this speech where he just sort of says, like, I am a warrior. Like, everything in my life, you know, my entire life is built around training to be a warrior. And I'm fundamentally useless to society. Mm. Like, he saw the shift in warfare that was happening during World War II. And he said, like, that it's that, and he literally says the words, like, war is no longer survivable. Right. In a world where it's no longer survivable, you're not getting any of the benefit. And he thought there was a lot of benefit, like working out your testosterone, meeting another male on the battlefield, right? Mm-hmm. But for most of human history, both people walked away most of the time. Right. Guys died 3 weeks later from an infection, and for hundreds of thousands of years, no one even connected those dots. You know what I mean? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, like, that kind of conflict was a survivable situation, right? Yeah. What shifted is that war is no longer survivable.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But they're leveraging this desire that people have to be tested in that way in order to put people into those situations.
Yeah.
And then, and that's where the need to train in certain ways to get them to the point where you will become a killer, like a true killer, right? Yeah. Learn to revel in the victory of that and all of the emotions that come with that so that you'll keep doing it and do it even more efficiently.
Yeah.
Because the danger is that a guy does it and says, I will never do that again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
You know? And yeah. then you don't have a military, right? So it's not just about getting them to do it the first time. It's doing it the first time and ensuring that the experience they have is such that they will want to do it more and more and more, that it'll become an addiction.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I'm interested in that idea that it's like traumatizing and then a way to try to run away from the trauma or escape the trauma is just to keep doing it.
To keep doing it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I use the word addiction, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's exactly the way addictions work, right? You yeah. think they're helping you.
Right. Right.
And it feels really good. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. every time you do it, you're actually worse off than you were before, more anxiety, more, and so you have to do it more.
Right. Yeah, there's a short-term high, but then there's a long-term crash. And then, yeah, yeah, and you end up like feeling right. more empty inside, and then you exactly. got to fill up. Yeah.
And that's why all addiction is progressive. Like, it gets worse over time.
Yeah.
Because then you have to do more of it to fill an even deeper void, right? The deeper
right.
crash.
Right.
And that's exactly what happens. I mean, any observer of modern warfare, I mean, like, it's just obvious that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's why guys try to come home and they can't, you know?
Right.
Even
right.
me, after being a conscientious objector and everything, I got home and it was horrible. For the first 6 months that I was home, all I wanted to do was go back to the military.
Right. Because
I just
could
not function in a world of people who hadn't had that experience. Because, like, how they oriented to the world was just so fundamentally different than me. Right. And there's nowhere to get that hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You just, and so you're just like lost in the regular world. And it's, when I was in junior high, I had a scoutmaster. This guy worked at JPL, really smart guy. And I remember being really angry when I heard him say this, but we were on a camping trip in the Sierras. And he was having a conversation with one of the other dads who was pretty far left and said something. And then this guy, Don Collins, he says, the problem isn't that we have a Marine Corps. The problem is that we let them back into society afterwards.
Right.
And I thought, that's exactly how I felt, man.
You know? Yeah.
Like, I just, yeah. I cannot, I'm not a functional human being anymore. Like, that's the true story of once a Marine, always a Marine. Like, you just, like, you cannot get it out of you. That's a hard right. hit.
Yeah.
It's a powerful drug. And
right. so, yeah.
the withdrawal from that is intense and extreme and takes concerted effort and support from a lot of, like, you were part of that recovery for me. I mean, all of the mm-hmm. whole Deer Park Sangha. The
yeah.
number of people that it took
yeah.
to undo me,
right.
you know, my military experience was extreme, right?
Yeah.
Down to thousands of people in an anti-war protest in San Francisco when the second Gulf War started. You know what I mean? Like, that whole experience, right? I mean, it
yeah.
literally, it took thousands of people, you know, and years mm-hmm. to unravel once you get caught in that killing addiction cycle. You know, it's crazy.
And that speaks to how there's this structural system in which the thousands and thousands of people are creating the conditions to support you to go into that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there are many more thousands willing to do that, right, than to help you not.
Right. Like, I mean, you think like the flyover for Super Bowl, you know, like the...
Yep.
Yeah.
Which people don't even recognize. That's the sad thing.
Right.
There's so much of our general society, people don't even recognize that that's what that is.
Yeah.
That it's all part of a process of acclimating you to the machinery of war and an orientation towards life
mm-hmm.
that assumes that this is inevitable. Unescapable, and a foregone conclusion that we are going to have to go behave this way, right?
Yeah.
So that you never question whether maybe you don't. Maybe there's another way.
Yeah.
Right? Which actually, to get back to the book,
yeah,
is more in line with your innate human psyche.
Right.
Right? Because, the majority of people actually turns out really, really do not want to kill somebody else.
Right.
We're born innately with a sense of empathy and connection with our fellow beings, even those whom we haven't met and who may look very different or practice other religions or whatever the manufactured just difference or reason is, that an overwhelming majority of the people actually really are just hardwired to not want to take that life.
Yeah.
And so if we were looking for another way, it would be a way that's much more suited to our true natures.
Right.
Again, except for those other few, which I think we'll get to eventually, who come, but you know, they come pre-wired because of all the kinds of things we're talking about and their own trauma and abuse. Right. You
know? Right. Right. And yeah, so it's like for you, it was a Buddhist process. Well, as I know you did a lot of yoga too, so we could say Buddhist and Hindu culturally, but it's like,
well, yes. I mean, that was the healing process. I will have to say, I mean, I'll describe it in Buddhist terms.
Yeah.
But it was also, I mean, for me, it was a Shakespearean process also.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the real awakening for me was a combination of the Buddhism we're born with that you can't escape, which is just mindfulness.
Yeah.
Of just saying, I'm going to actually really pay attention to how I actually feel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In this moment, I'm going to try to be present to what's truly going on inside of me when I'm doing these things or when I'm being asked to do these things. Right.
Yeah.
And at the same time, at the time when I was becoming a conscious objector, it was actually reading John Donne's Meditation 17 and William Shakespeare, Henry IV, who were asking some pretty serious questions about ethics and morality and what is my connection to other people and what, you know, and those books cracked a window open to make me say, okay, that's what allowed me to say, okay, I'm gonna actually see, how do I really feel about this?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, in Buddhist terms, it was this mindfulness. I actually was being coached into some mindfulness to say, how really am I? And that's when I started to realize, really, I don't like this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
this is not good for me. And for me, that was the basis of my whole objection, was just honestly, was just to, like, you know, it might be good for some folk, but this clearly is actually not, this does not feel good.
Right. You know? When you look at the behavior patterns and you stop just automatically identifying with them, because that's just such, it's been such a habit for so long that it's just this automatic identification with it. And then when you actually look at it as it is in the present moment, it's like, yeah, it's like that identifying with it is like weakened or diminished to a certain degree.
Right. It starts to explode that. Right.
Yeah.
And it starts to, in very real ways, undo the training.
And so there's something about that witnessing self or observing self that is also somehow just inherently connected to whatever we want to call it, true nature, Buddha nature, some inherent goodness. And it's like, yeah, breaking through the conditioning and getting in touch with that, like, just true nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's key, right? And it's, And again, I can only speak from my own experience, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that what is the appropriate role of, you know, policing and violence in the world? And, you know, there are still other people who are really suffering and are going to try to, you know, do violence to people. And how do you intercede with that? And I mean, that's a whole other topic of conversation that we've talked about before. Yeah. But I think that even if it turns out hypothetically that there is a role for like a global police force that really will, you know, stand toe to toe with an aggressor. And, you know, if we even assume that as a reality,
mm-hmm.
You as an individual, you're still better off knowing whether you're the person who really should be the one doing that or not. Right.
Yeah.
Does this speak to your true nature? Right. Cause I do believe, I know that there were people in the military that I was in the military with who, not the insane ones, who were generally good people, mm-hmm. who were not traumatized the way I was. And I think because they had a different kind of relationship with what was going on, right? And even if they didn't like it,
mm-hmm.
and wished it was another way, they just related to it differently, right? And so I think, you know, everybody's at their own place in how much karma they're burning and where they're at, right? And so I don't want to speak for other people and what might be good or not good. I think the solution is, the only answer to that is what's good or not good, right or not right for you. Right? And the only way to know that is to break through the training, the indoctrination, you know, whether it's military or societal in general or educational or wherever it came from, and get to some brass tacks of presence and mindfulness.
Yeah.
And what is really happening in me right now? You know, not what do I wish was happening? What do I think should be happening? You know, all of the traps that we fall into, but what is really happening, you know, in my body? And for me, I'm always an advocate. I think the body, and I learned this from you at the monastery. I mean, like, you know, starting with what's happening in my body is actually a really good place to cut through all the BS that's spinning around in my head. Like, how do I feel in this moment? You know, like my stomach, I'm tense. I'm the, you know, right?
Yeah, to see, like, yeah, from a Buddhist perspective as well as from somatic trauma therapy perspective, that the real driver of behavior is body sensation and then the reactive emotion that can come up from it. And if you want to, what they're finding in terms of trying to heal trauma is that if you just take the cognitive behavioral approach, you're just dealing with the narrative or the story and you don't get into the body, it doesn't,
the actual trauma
really do the job. Say again?
You don't get into the actual trauma.
Yeah.
Right? Where it's rooted in. And I will say most, there's all kinds of trauma, right? But the particular subject that we're talking about, like the trauma is very much bodily. Like like it is your body that is at risk here. That's what you are trying to say. That's what is very physically uncomfortable in this moment. Because no matter what the particular warfare situation you're in,
mm-hmm.
you've been going through hell to get there. You're hungry, you're tired, you're bitten by 10,000 fleas. You know what I mean? Like this is a bodily experience.
Right.
So people forget that, I think, a lot, actually, that it's a primally physical and physiological experience, not so much just a mental one.
So then I want to pivot a little bit and talk about, okay, so one of the main topics that he discusses in the book is basically, the more distance you have, if you're the one who's doing the killing, the more distance you have between you and the person you're killing, the easier it is to kill. And he talks about physical distance as well as emotional distance. And so it's easier for someone to drop a bomb from a plane than someone to shoot someone they can see with a gun. It's easier if you're part of a group doing it as opposed to just you individually. It's easier if you're part of a chain of command and you're just following orders of a hierarchy structure versus you know, you deciding yourself to do it. It's easier if you have like technological distance, like if it's like night vision goggles or, well, I mean, yeah, you could think like the ultimate distance is like a drone pilot yeah. sitting somewhere in Colorado and a drone's flying over somewhere in Afghanistan. And that a lot of the military training, as well as what we could say, our society as a whole, I mean, American political system, society as a whole, capitalism, it runs on dehumanizing the other, creating distance so that we can justify whatever. Yeah, that it's again, so we can justify our addiction, basically. So I'm wondering, yeah, in terms of, yeah, your training and like looking back, like how the system as a whole tried to create that kind of distance emotionally, physically.
Yeah. So I think it's important that you say like physically and emotionally, right?
Yeah.
Because they're always combining those things in a way. Mm. Right. And the thing that you mentioned also the drone thing, and I think this is important because one of the things that happens, and so in the book they talk about this, but like switching from bullseye targets to silhouette shaped targets, right?
Right, like the training for World War II, you're on the rifle range shooting at, you know, a piece of paper that has a circle on it with rings in a bullseye. And then the training for Vietnam was that you're walking through like a simulated village and then these life-size pop-up human-shaped targets come up, and so you just shoot. As soon as it pops up, you shoot at it.
Yeah, so you're being trained, right, that the human is the target, right?
Yeah.
And in that scenario, and also on the rifle range where everyone does their qual, right?
Yeah.
Those targets also are human-shaped. I don't know why they're called dog targets, at least in the Marine Corps. I don't know why they call them that. But like I could this day recite, there's this whole ritual and this matters, you know, ready on the left, ready on the right, already on the firing line. You may commence firing when your dog target appears. Boom. You know what I mean? That this whole thing.
Yeah.
But the whole point is they build ritual and everything's gamified. This matters. And this is, we come into the drone context, people playing video games. Now it does translate right to a guy sitting in Arizona, you know, bringing a drone, that the view starts to look the same. Right.
Yeah.
And you have this history of playing this game where it's a competition, right? So I'm on the rifle range, or I'm in, you know, MEPS in the little combat town where the things are popping up, doing what I'm doing, right? It's always a competition, right? So you're being trained in the fact that you're playing this game, and all, like I said, the fact that I can still recite like the ritual around it and everything really comes into play because I can remember being in the field where it's real. And you're talking to your buddies the same way.
Yeah.
You know, like someone will say, oh man, that was a tight grouping. Just the same way you would on the target. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You're actually you are literally engaging that experience as if it's the range.
Yeah.
Right. When you're at a distance again, right. When you can do that at a distance. And that's part of that. That's part of what's trying to be accomplished, actually, right? Is to get you to have a different frame of mind around the activity so that you can trick yourself into thinking that you're not really killing somebody, right? It's right. Just a game.
Yeah, it's an illusion that you're trying to generate.
Yeah, you know. And it's extremely effective. It just turns out, like, we are super good at lying to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We're super good at it just on our own. We come up with lies and justifications and, you know, for how we behave and move through the world. Well, when you have the full weight of the United States military training you consistently that this is just a game, this is just a game, this is just a game, right?
Yeah.
That starts to sink in this ritualistic ways. Mm-hmm. And it has to be ritualistic. It has to be, we have these certain rituals and things that we do. Because the weird thing is that at the same time, they are always, in horrible ways, drilling into you that this is life and death, but it doesn't matter because they aren't really human.
Right, right.
The racism and the tribalism in the rhetoric in the military is so insanely offensive. I mean, it's just like incredible, you know? And it's all this act. So they have this other, all any of the rhetoric that's making this real is always wrapped up in the sense that they in fact aren't really humans, right? Yeah. You're just killing these just like, you know, horrible creatures that are trying to disrupt everything, you know what I mean, that you would ever want to do, you know. And in the Marine Corps, it gets very personal. Like, you know, and so in the Marine Corps, Susie is your girlfriend. Everybody's girlfriend back home is named Susie in the Marine Corps.
Right,
right. That's just how it is. You know what I mean? And that guy over there is fucking Susie, man, while you're gone. You know, you just know it's happening. You know? Right. I mean, like, this is what's being told to you all the time, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So there's like, it's this very, they're always trying to dehumanize and make them an aggressor and make you feel like, okay, like, once again, I'm not really killing somebody who's actually exactly like me,
right?
You know,
right.
And has a family at home and is not sleeping with my Susie because he's got his own Susie and he just wants to get home too, just like I do.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
Right. And some kids and, you know, really just wants to, you know, feed his family, you know,
right.
You know, that we don't talk about that. It's always, and it's funny because you can tell if you really want to know, like, who we're going to war with next.
Mm-hmm.
Spend a day in Marine Corps boot camp and just listen to what population they're dehumanizing right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm here to tell you, we were dehumanizing the Muslims long before we ever put a boot on the ground.
Right.
It was in my time in that we shifted from dehumanizing the Chinese and Mexicans to Muslims.
Yeah.
Because they knew this is where we're going. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't because Saddam Hussein crossed the line and took an oil field that we had given him permission to take or any of that. It's because that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to establish a presence out there. And we, you know what I mean?
Right.
So we started long before that dehumanizing, you know, the way they dress, the way they talk, the way the whole thing, right? Because then again, it makes it easier to overcome your innate sense that we're actually in this together.
Yeah. So it's like splitting you in half, and like half of you is associated with your body, and then the other half that you're projecting out is associated with this other. And instead of the reality that it's like we're interdependent, one whole reality, it's like, no, there's two realities and you're on one side and the other side is like a different, it's a different reality.
Like fundamentally different.
Yeah.
Right. And this will get to the people who I think come in just happy to kill and willing to kill.
Yeah.
Is that there's a class of people through just, I mean, I think it's about karma.
Yeah.
That gets inherited from generation to generation. And about abuse that's happening in childhood and all of that, who sort of come fully formed, already believing it is us against them.
Right.
I don't know who the them is, but damn it, there's got to be a them, you know, and they're coming to get me. Right. And so as soon as the military puts a face to that them, it's game on. Right.
Yeah.
It just feeds right into that. And so that's why we're really, you know, in trouble. I mean, I guess I'm going to say that. I mean, things are where they are, but because it's been, you know, we now have generations of people, you know, who've gone through this indoctrination, who've then produced whole new generations of people who've never been in the military in any way, but are actually still the victims of this mindset, right?
Yeah.
And it's just really interesting, you know. I just the other day I was at the gym and this guy works out at my gym and I see him all the time, seems like a nice guy, a good guy, and the Army Navy football game is on TV, right? And he starts talking about Army Navy and he says something about the military, you know, because I can't help myself, I chime in a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
He was just so laudatory about the military.
Mm-hmm.
But like, he's, you know, he said, I'm just a huge supporter and all the camaraderie and all these things. Like, he had never been in the military ever, right?
Yeah.
And I really like wanted to ask him, like, what reality are you basing this on?
Yeah.
You know? Like, where, but right, it's so pervasive in our society that even if you're not in, you actually are already wired that way.
Yeah. And this idea of like, it's like this chicken and egg thing. And like, basically it's just this collective addiction that we have. And it's like, we've long been past any war that could remotely be seen as just war. Even that term we could debate, but like, okay, killing Hitler overall, good idea. But like, since then, there has been no military conflict that we've been involved in that like had any good reason at all. So it is only just this habit energy of the addiction to killing, basically. And then like, as a culture, as a society, it's just, we have this addiction. And yeah, so it's just, as soon as like one enemy is no longer there, then we will just make another one up, because the point is not to win the war. The point is just to be able to keep fighting.
Yeah, the point is to be at war.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and I really, I mean, anytime I hear people talking about whatever the conflict is, and this has been going on since the first Gulf War in my world, and you know what I mean, stuff where, you know, well, it's the oil. And my response is always, it has nothing to do with any of that. It's because this is what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all, plain and simple, right? I mean,
yeah.
any reason's as good as the next.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like this addiction to tribalism and killing and, this hypermasculinity, homophobia, misogyny.
Yeah.
This overall addiction to, toxic masculinity. And then,
it's a tough thing. And we've talked about this in other contexts. And I think we're going to talk about this again in another future episode.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I just always feel like I want to throw the disclaimer out there also, which is to say that because of the way this works, because of the way karma works, it's also really important to understand that the people themselves in the military are like, bar none, some of the best people I've ever met and known in my life. And I'm so grateful to have actually been with those men. And they were predominantly men in my day. You know what I mean? So it's not that's the reality of my world. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that that's not true actually now. It's that fine line, you know, the fact that there's the addiction and the bloodlust is not actually the fault of the individual who's in it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's their karma, you know, and that's the world they were trained into, and all of this stuff to bring to that. What we'll talk about later is that doesn't alleviate the individual for the responsibility of doing the work to burn their karma, right? Mm-hmm. But that's very different than sort of saying that's a bad person.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's actually really important. I mean, because the flip side of it is that those, you know, many of the men that I served with, they are the kind of people who would do anything, including, you know, put their life on the line to help another person.
Right. Right?
They believe that that's what they're doing, and that's why they do it. Right. And that's commendable, actually. It's incredibly unselfish.
Yeah.
And in my CO thing, people gave up their careers to keep me alive. Even when I was resisting, right? Wow. And that's the kind of people many of these people are. And so I always just feel like I want to, because it can start to sound like I'm just like railing against the people. You know, again, I think that we all have a responsibility to wake up. So I don't want to let people totally off the hook, but I just want to get that out there that, you know, there's also a lot of good traits that go there too. I mean, people who work really, really hard, who, you know what I mean, will do incredibly unselfish things, and you know.
Yeah, and I think that
they're tapping into that too, right? And imagine if we directed that energy towards other things, it would be amazing. You know, I mean, like, amazing what we could accomplish as a society.
Right. It's this. I mean, this raw biological material. This raw energy that can be channeled in different ways, and then the problem is, we don't know how to channel it in the right way. Like, we don't have a healthy model of how would we channel this in the right way.
Right.
And then
where is the Marine Corps that does good, right?
Yeah.
Where you can take your totally testosterone driven, you know what I mean, insecurities.
Right.
And go prove yourself, right?
Yeah. Which I think, I mean, that's what's interesting of, because I used to be a monk, you used to be in the military, and I feel like there's a lot of overlap between
totally
those two things. And so I feel like when you hear about like Ajahn Chah in Thailand, like these Thai forest monks and nuns that like literally will just walk around in the forest and sleep outside, and like their meditation practice, they're like hours and hours a day, and it's like they're an Olympic athlete, basically. It's like this intense.
Yeah, exactly. They found a place, right, to do that.
Yeah. And you feel like these people are just badass. Like there's this.
Yeah. No, I totally get that, right?
Yeah. Like with Buddhism, like Ajahn Chah, these Thai Forest masters, like these are like badasses, like doing some badass shit. And it's like, it's fucking cool. Okay. And then, I feel like Western culture, like we lost the monastic contemplative practice deal. And then, so then Christianity just kind of lost it lost that intensity. And you could argue, and like there's fundamental issues that prevented it from maintaining that intensity in the contemplative practice. But anyway,
I'm with you, and I've been thinking a lot about this too. So like, I think that we keep looking for, like, at least I do, and a lot of people I know keep looking sort of for, well, what's the alternative to the way we do it, right?
Yeah.
Or let's disband the military and be, you know, and find another organization to channel it somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
But you said a key thing, like, that not all monastic practices are that badass, right?
Right.
So, yeah. Like, people gravitate to different levels, right?
Yeah.
So here's my thing that I've been thinking, and I'm dead serious about this, like, it might be really, really fucking badass to like rappel out of a helicopter, you know, and mm-hmm. go into a building, you know, and shoot your way through 20 people and kill mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden, right?
Yeah.
But would it not have been more badass to rappel out of a helicopter, get your way all the way through there without firing a single fucking round?
Yeah.
You know, I actually, like, I wanted to get this t-shirt made the other day. I was thinking, like real heroes leave their weapons holstered. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it not more brave to walk into that battlefield environment and say, I'm going to capture that flag without actually having to take another life? Like, I submit to you that that's like the ultimate badass, right?
Yeah, and that's like when you...
And I think that's what we need to be pushing that way, is to sort of say, like, let's see what would happen if we just shifted to military training, and let's accept the fact that, like, people have a need to like prove how bad they are, ass they are, and go, that was pretty badass that you went out and killed those five people, but this guy over here who like got all the way through and never had to fire a round,
yeah,
total fucking badass, you know.
And that in the Lakota tribe, Native Americans, they literally have that it's called counting coup.
Yeah,
you're right. A warrior. And you're able to get close enough to touch another warrior with a stick, and survive and get away from it.
Yeah.
And that was considered like more brave, more courageous, like
yeah.
the ultimate. Like,
because it is, right? I mean, I didn't accept taking the guy out of from a major distance. I didn't. I was actually willing to land boots on the ground and go in there, right, and yeah. navigate that situation. I can't remember the guy's name. There's an interesting analog. So Mortal Kombat,
mm-hmm.
I think it was the game, one of these like big multiplayer online war games, right?
Yeah.
And every year they have a championship, right? One of these major things. And mm-hmm. one time a guy who won without ever firing a round.
Yeah.
Like he actually went in to kind of prove that you could, you know, just form alliances and talk, you know what I mean?
Right.
And like strategically navigate the situation and get to the final goal, whatever that is, without actually killing anybody. And he totally did. And he won this huge international competition. And I just think that, and you know, I mean, this would be a hard thing, but I just think that so much of our anti-militarism comes off as being anti-badass.
Yeah.
And I'm in a kind of and I did this myself when I first became a CO and everything like that, but I've since come around to recognizing that there was some real necessary purity mm-hmm. to my need to badass it a little bit when I was, you know, 19.
Yeah.
You know, and that this may be not actually a bad thing, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. maybe okay. And that same energy is what gets us to the top of Everest and to get, you know what I mean? Like I'm not so down on being a badass as I used to be. Just that we need to assess what really is badass, right?
Yeah.
Is it really badass to like out-weapon some guy and have a bunch of cluster bombs? And that, like, I say no, actually, it's not at all, right? Yeah. It's pretty much the coward's way out.
Yeah.
You know, badass is, you know, mano a mano or person on person, right? And so I just think I'm starting to feel like it might be more productive to intervene in different ways for me anyway.
Yeah.
In my own thinking about this. I will say too, importantly, it's also giving me a way, and this is, you know, more personal, but it's allowing me to love my past self.
Mm-hmm.
In ways that I think are actually important for healing.
Yeah.
Which then I think extend to the rest of how I relate to the rest of the world, right? Which is to say, like, that's okay. There's a point in time where that's okay, right?
Right.
To want to be tested in that way and to want to do that. And so let's just redefine what that means, right? What are those tests?
Yeah. Yeah, I know, like, in Thailand, it's traditional for teenage boys to become monks temporarily and to do meditation and it's like a rite of passage. Or as I taught this book on world religions this past semester, this guy Maladoma Same, who's from Burkina Faso, which is in West Africa near Ghana, and he's talking about his initiation ritual that he had to go through, him and the other young men around his age. And again, it's a patriarchal thing, so that the women didn't do the initiation ritual. So that's another topic. But basically, they're doing like super intense, like psychedelic, like voyages into different dimensions of reality. Like super intense stuff, and it's like I can see, okay, yeah, this is meeting the need for that intensity,
right.
But it's like overall a good thing. It's like becoming more connected with the natural world, different dimensions of reality, relating with each other. It's like, okay, this is a proper initiation ritual.
Yeah, I just think when I was maybe 26 or 27, and I was lifeguarding, and all the sheriffs used to come hang out in the lifeguard headquarters. It's a great place to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look at the beach, it's nice. So one day there's like six sheriffs hanging out in there.
Yeah.
And they're all having this conversation, showing off which gun they carry, right? Mm. Yeah. None of them are carrying like an issue service revolver, which you can do. They all have I bought this Glock 9 that I bought, and they all have these different weapons, and they're all have, you know, swapping stories about how great their gun is. And I'll never forget this one guy, Ron, in the middle of the whole thing, he says, you know, I've been on this job for 15 years and I've never pulled my weapon once, and I hope I never have to.
Yeah.
And I was like, that he's the biggest badass in the room.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, he's the one, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, who's like finding a way, you know what I mean? And he was a big guy, and he's just like, but he's like, no, like, that's not what this is about for me. Right. And this is the problem with the militarized training of our police, right? Is now they think that that's the badass thing. Right.
Yeah.
But I, again, that's just like thing. Like, why does it make you more badass? Because you can afford a bigger gun. that's actually a pretty low threshold for badass, really, you know what I mean? So I do think we need to start cultivating this attitude that the more macho-y badass thing to do is to keep it in the holster.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Figure out a way to walk right into that situation where someone else is admittedly, you know, dangerous and has a weapon, and don't outgun them, outperform them.
Yeah.
You know, emotionally, mentally, physically. Right.
Yeah. I remember there's this, story. I can't remember where it's from, but basically this guy is like a high level martial artist. He's from the US, and he's in a subway. I can't remember if it's New York or somewhere. He's in a subway, and there's somebody on the subway that is like starting to be violent and like assaulting a woman or about to, and like, so he's like, okay, I'm the guy here. I got the training. It's my responsibility basically to intervene. Like because I have this training, I need to use it to take this guy down. Like, I don't want to hurt him, but I also don't want him to be able to. So he's about to like move forward and try to bring the guy down. And then there's this old man sitting in the subway car, and he like basically like with a soft heart, like just sees the guy as somebody who's upset and like just genuinely asks him how he's, I can't, it's like whatever words he says is basically like compassion straight into the guy's heart.
Right. And just disarms him, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, yeah. And it's like, oh, what's that? Like how how is he able?
This is also part of the problem, though, in the modern warfare situation.
Yeah.
Is again, with the distance, it's not person on person, right?
Yeah.
So, like, the person that needed to do that, you know, for the present conflict,
yeah,
you know, was, you know, George Bush and Osama bin Laden. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, please tell me about your suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, exactly. No, legitimately, tell me about your suffering. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and then when you do that, there will be an initial long period of time where the person's just spouting off their anger and bullshit. Right.
Yeah.
And then you ask again, but tell me about your suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And about the third time you get to brass tacks.
Yeah.
Right. And then you start to feel like what's really at stake here. Right.
Yeah.
What are you really afraid of? You know? And that's what this always comes down to, is what is the person afraid of, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what need is not going to be met?
Yeah.
You feel so strongly that it's not going to be met that you're ready to lash out violently, right? But it takes a lot, and you have to get hit a lot to get to that.
Yeah.
Right? You have to be on, maybe physically, maybe verbally, right? You know, but you have to live through a lot of attack and aggression while the person kind of works through, you know, their spin that they're in.
Yeah.
Before they kind of, okay, now we've gotten that over with, right?
Yeah.
And now we can actually communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Right? But we're not trained to do that. And the problem is that that's happening. Our leaders have to be able to do that with each other. Because then that's who's giving the order, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was for me, and that's the kind of Shakespeare, the Henry play thing. That was the real issue for me, was like, what is my role in this?
Yeah.
Does that absolve me of moral responsibility here? You know, do I get to kill this person and wash my hands of it? Because those guys up there couldn't get their shit together.
You know? Yeah.
And even when I was totally into it, I still saw very clearly that this was about two guys not being able to get their shit together. Right? Like, that was pretty damn obvious.
You know?
But no matter how, you know, and that's not to say there wasn't bad or that, but still, it's like, clearly, like, people can't get their shit together. Now we're going to have to kill each other. Does that absolve me of my responsibility, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I the answer was no.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can't just push off my moral responsibility because two other people can't get their shit together.
Yeah.
I got to get my shit together, right?
Right.
But even if you decide that, the way the modern military works, you're given orders to do it, and now you're doing it at the distance, and so it's easier to do, And you go, well, my, you know, it seems so much like it's just part of this game and I'm not really killing anybody, but maybe I am. But you can tell yourself you didn't. You know what I mean? And there's this whole thing going on. And then, you know, the ace in the hole is that ultimately, if it ever does come to like face-to-face kind of thing, you know, now you're just so terrified you'll do anything. Right? So you've already been put in a highly compromised situation that ensures that you know, again, you're going to behave badly unless you had a tremendous amount of training to counteract that impulse.
Yeah. Right? So it's either you're going to be involved in killing where there's enough distance that it doesn't, that the innate resistance doesn't come up, or you're put in a situation where it's kill or be killed. And then your survival just takes over.
Just takes over. Yeah. Cause who's trained to have it not, right? Nobody,
right.
You know, nobody in the military anyway, very few people, right? I mean, you have to have a very concerted, like even for me, for my ACO thing, you have to have made a very stubborn conscious decision about how you're going to behave.
Yeah.
And then just follow through on it out of sheer stubbornness and lack of not caring what happens anymore. You know what I mean? Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
But unless you go into that attitude, then you're going to respond the way any, you know, like truly sane person does. Right. I mean, we're kind of hardwired in that last throngs.
Yeah.
Most people.
And that, yeah, I remember this documentary, which I haven't been able to find since I saw it, that, when I was at living in Plum Village in France, this African-American nun had a videotape of Martin Luther King in Chicago when they're doing the marches to desegregate the neighborhoods. And so you see him in the church, like they're doing a lot of preparation in the church, like in the weeks leading up to it. And like Mahalia Jackson's there and they're all singing gospel songs together. And so, yeah, at one point in the sermon, he's like, okay, you got to get over being afraid of dying or you won't be able to do the right thing.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the, like you
that's
have
the
to,
crux of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, okay, our collective addiction to war, like the society as a whole, I mean, you can just imagine, like, if we are like, okay, really, I mean, come on, like, what country are we involved in the Middle East or Latin America where we actually need to be there, as opposed to we could cut the military budget, like, down to like 20% of what it is now and basically, yeah, spend all that money on like renewable energy and like Green New Deal. So, okay, that like logically and economically it's possible, but collectively as a society, our addiction to the military as like, it's just like we're addicted to eating red meat. I mean, it's the tribalism, it's the same, like there'll be this big hole that like people will, that it's like literally an addict, if you take away their drug, they're going to go through withdrawal and freak out. And like,
yeah, that's exactly what happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do believe that it's a literal withdrawal. I mean, like we would not know what to do with ourselves.
Right. Like that's how we've defined ourselves as a country from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so then it would take this collective willingness. Cause yeah, I mean, we're talking about the leaders as well as the individuals. It's like there has to be this collective willingness to face our trauma and addiction.
I'm trying to decide if it's depressing or not.
Well, that's what I mean, like from a Buddhist,
how do you get to that, right? I mean, like
this is like Buddhism, like and I was talking about this with Nick on our winter solstice episode of there's this paradox in Buddhism where on one level there is no problem. I mean, it's just,
yeah, exactly, there is no problem. Yeah.
This is samsara, like if you're attached to it being one way or the other, that's part of samsara. And so, yeah, it's never going to be good. And then, so like this teaching that Thay is a teaching from the Buddha, like the better way to catch a snake. If you take that teaching and catch it the right way, it's like you grab the snake behind its head and he can't bite you. So you could use that perspective, like we're talking about with Martin Luther King, that you cultivate a fearlessness. You're not afraid of death anymore. So then you do the right thing. And so then, yeah, it's this weird, like.
It's true, but I mean, I'm finding myself wondering, like, I'll admit that I do, my way of coping with life in general is to, I tend most of the time to fall on the side of, it actually isn't a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're all having the experience that we're having, right?
Yeah.
And karma is real. And the problem is, if you're not trying to burn your karma, then you've missed an opportunity to grow.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's kind of, that said, I also believe in engaged Buddhism, and I do think we should be working to do better, you know, as a society. But I think a little bit of, I think there's some truth in the sort of Karate Kid, you know, wax on, wax off thing here.
Yeah.
That, you know, training the snake to catch the snake the right way, you know, probably you're actually never going to have to catch a snake.
Yeah.
You know, but that training is serving lots of other purposes and will be of value in other ways, right?
Yeah.
And so I tend to think that we're probably never going to solve like the war problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, I think it's unlikely, because I think that there's all kinds of spiritual work being done by people working through that. And you know what I mean? And addiction in general, it's why there is addiction. It's real, you know, but there's huge learning that comes from actually beating it, you know, and solving it at the individual level, but like addiction as a disease is part of the human condition, right? And I think it's probably going to be for a long, long time. And I think war is kind of the same way. But I think the efforts that we make to try to find a better way are likely to have individual payouts.
Mm-hmm.
And because of interbeing, those payouts are huge societal payouts, you know? Yeah. I mean, my transformation is not because Carl was so great and had insights. It came, as I sort of said, it started with just reading the canon of English literature.
Yeah.
You know, and ideas that were so fundamentally, radically different from what I had been taught growing up, that it cracked some things loose. And then that started me to look spiritually, you know. I mean, I was, you know, raised Christian, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Christian with a little bit of a bent that had a transcendental bent to it, that's kind of made open a door towards Buddhist, you know, ways of looking at the world. And I, you know, and so, you know, all of those efforts that people made did not end warfare, right?
Yeah.
But did change my experience of it fundamentally. I don't think I'm the only one.
Right. Yeah.
And, so I, you know, I want a lot of the wins at an individual level, right? And not judge like what success or failure because we didn't manage to, you know, completely produce a pacifist society. And so, like, you know, think, I want to think globally, right? Act locally and accept wins locally, you know, and individually as being actually huge, much more important than we think they are, again, because inner being is the true nature of reality.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And that, it gets back to, again, what Nick and I talked about on that solstice episode, which we're going to release on the solstice in a couple of days.
Awesome.
That for me, I, my understanding of Buddhist practice, a lot of it's informed by the Goenka Vipassana, those 10-day retreats. So it boils the whole process down to, you're in the present moment, you're experiencing body sensations. There's the tendency when there's a pleasant sensation to try to grab on. There's a tendency when there's an unpleasant sensation to push it away. And so the practice is to develop awareness and equanimity towards the body sensations so that you can let go of the reactions.
Right.
And that is the rubber hitting the road as far as the Four Noble Truths and the overall Buddhist project. You could say that this is one way of saying what the core of Buddhism is about. So that practice then of, I'm in the present moment, what body sensation do I experience? What reactions are coming up? Letting go of those reactions, and then coming back to the body sensations. And then from there, then there will be positive, wholesome actions that arise that are based on interbeing.
And so it'll happen on every front. People who are in the military, you know, I mean, I think the impact of that is huge, right?
Yeah.
Across all dimensions of experience.
Exactly. Right. No matter what situation you're in, that basic way of approaching it is valid.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing. So that's the multi-purpose tool, right?
Yes.
And I do think, interestingly, and I really do believe this, I think that right there is actually that and not my own conscientious objectiveness is why my son rejected the military and is, you know, doesn't play war video games and, you know, I mean, is very not a lot like a lot of his peers.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that I never talk about the whole time he was, I basically never talked about my military stuff.
Yeah.
Ever. Like it, you know, I mean, I don't think he would have known one way or another. You know, I mean, he kind of knew I was in the Marine Corps because someone would mention every once in a while.
Yeah.
But I don't think he knew I was a CO. It just was not something I talked about it with you.
Yeah.
You're the first person I ever talked about it with outside of, and I just never talked about it at home. So I actually don't think that was exerting a big pressure on his decisions. It's not like he was being trained to be that in any way. Mm-hmm. And also in following the precepts about not indoctrinating, which, you know what I mean? Like I think he has to make his own decisions.
Yeah.
But he was definitely raised in the Sangha.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And trained in this type of mindfulness, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, I think the indoctrination that starts in our society before one ever gets to the military to be trained could not take hold.
Right.
Because I think even when those things were being suggested, he innately found that very unattractive.
Right.
And his innate sense that killing is not something he wanted to be involved in was able to stay forefront with him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he was naturally sort of asking, how does that sit? How does that feel in me? And going, not so much. Right.
Right.
And so I do think you've hit on the key here to this thing is to not worry about the realm in which we're trying to intervene. Because also it's important to know, like, what do I know? All of my knowledge is transient. You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. So like I can be totally wrong. I mean, like the military could be the most necessary thing on the planet for, you know what I mean? Like I could be wrong. Right.
Yeah.
But mindfulness cannot be wrong. You know, like relating to one's true nature and the reality of what's actually happening in you in any moment is an undeniable real truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when we stick to training that, we're producing people who become less susceptible to deception and indoctrination in all areas.
Yeah. And I think it's that, like, not only did you not talk about it with him, but you, from when he was very young, you were already practicing mindfulness of your body sensations and emotions. So then that's the overall imprint that you're having on him is changing. And then also, like, in your relating to him as a father in terms of, like, discipline or structure, like, I can remember times when he was like a teenager and he was like angry about something and you were just mindfully like supporting him to just recognize, okay, anger's coming up. Yeah. And because I think this is key. It's like, if I'm practicing awareness and equanimity with my body sensations, and then that means that, the actions that I'm giving rise to are holistically good vibrations. Like the vibrations are good, like through and through. And that's the deepest level of communication I have with another being is the overall vibrational impact I'm having on them. And so then, like your relationship with him was about that as well.
Yeah, and I think that's huge. But I do want to give I mean, like, due credit where it is, and because I think it's important that, like, a parent is not enough.
Right.
The Sangha is crucial.
Yeah.
Because he was surrounded by that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just surrounded by it all the time in his, in very formative, his most formative years. Yeah. Right. And we let him, when he got to be a teen and wanted to hang out with his friends and stuff like that, we didn't force him to go and never, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, didn't make him to do it. And then, so our time, you know, we started spending less time at Deer Park, and that was really why, because he had other things he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But there's no undoing those, you know, like, I mean, 0 to 12. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, it just is in him energetically that, like, when anger comes up, you deal with anger. Right. You know,
yeah.
When this comes up, you recognize that that's there, like you said, and you be with that. Right. And you, you don't, you know, haul off and find something external to do that's theoretically going to solve it. Right.
Yeah.
And never does.
Yeah.
You know, which is what mostly what we're trained. And maybe we've talked about this before, but I actually do think, like, the biggest disservice that was ever done to me, and what I think is, like, the pinnacle for my generation of Western indoctrination, which it pains me to say because it's one of the most tightly written screenplays. It was a work of writing. It's phenomenal. Yeah. Is the first Rocky movie. Right? Where the lesson is, he's getting the shit kicked out of him, and he's like, he's getting killed out there. No, he's getting angry, you know? Yeah. And it's like, when he finally gets angry enough, then he beats the world champion. Right? Yeah. And like, that's the lesson. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And it is like the exact opposite wrong lesson. You know, to have a successful life, right? Yeah. And I feel like my whole generation was like indoctrinated that this is the way. Like, get really fucking pissed off, and then that will give you the energy to do amazing great things. Right?
Yeah.
You know? Get really, really scared, you know. Yeah. And then you'll somehow be a phenomenal individual instead of recognizing the truth of the matter is, and I really mean this, like, and I've done a lot of reading, a lot of history. Like, if you really look back through history, it's not an accident that, like, most of the people we revere are, like, people of tremendous faith.
And
because that faith is what brings the calm and the not behaving that way. Right. And a practice that is the antithesis of the Rocky approach to life. But unfortunately, like, America is structured around the Rocky approach to life.
Right.
And that's the problem we have to solve. And that will solve the on-killing problem.
Yeah.
Because if every single person really asks, like, how am I really relating to this? You'd be like, yeah, not so much. Let's stop imagining this as a game, and let's truly recognize that that's a real person.
Yeah.
At the other end of the weapon. You know what I mean? That's what where that round is going. So let's stop being proud that I can, you know, get a tight circle at 1,000 meters, you know, and recognize that what I'm actually being doing is, you know, every single shot you should be reminded ahead of time, like, that you're about to kill a person.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Every single shot. Okay. Clear your mind. All the bullshit. Now really imagine, like, that's a real person there and you're about to kill him. How do you feel?
Yeah.
If you were, we have no ability to do that. I can't get on base and whisper that in every Marine's ear.
Yeah.
But if you were already trained to just do that in all of the things that you do.
Yeah.
To really be present to what is real, you're really doing and what's really happening. Things would work very different in the world.
Yeah. And I think that's we basically have to rehumanize ourselves as opposed to dehumanize, like, ourselves and the other person. And so it's like, So Dave Grossman, now he's like one of the most popular workshop leaders for police. He's not like in the academy itself, but it's like they have like continuing education credits or whatever they have to get. So he's like one of the most popular workshops. And so it's like we could be like the way we're training police, it could be radically different. Like it could be a completely different incentive structure, and yeah, based on humanizing each other instead of dehumanizing each other.
And you know what's really interesting about that?
Yeah.
The people for whom that would be the absolute best thing would be the police themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really truly believe that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I mean, these are people who, you know, who are in fact facing horrible circumstances on a daily basis all the time.
Yeah.
You know, some putting themselves in harm's way, others just confronting, like, you know, the deepest levels of suffering as it manifests itself in our society, right? At all levels, is extremely stressful and traumatizing, right? Yeah. If you could go into that, like, truly, you know, where your natural instinct is one of mindfulness and presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I really think, like, that's where the trauma, that's when it stops being traumatizing.
Yeah.
And, by the way, it produces a better outcome.
Yeah.
It's win-win across the board, right? But we're doing exactly the opposite. We're training them to be more militarized, more dehumanized. I truly believe that. And that is my problem, you know, is that I think we're actually just continuing to make it worse. Because we're, and the reason why he's the most popular one is basically saying, teach us even better how to dehumanize. Because when you dehumanize the victim, the person on the other end of the round, you're also dehumanizing the shooter.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what no one realizes, right?
Yeah.
You cannot dehumanize one without dehumanizing other, because you're moving the shooter farther away from their base innate instincts as a person, as a human being.
Right.
You're dehumanizing both people in that. And that causes intense suffering. And that's why our police force suffers, and it's a horrible job. Because of that, we need to roll that back, you know, for the benefit of the police as well as society.
Yeah. Like the example in Ohio where there's like a young black kid on a playground with like a toy gun, and then the police car rolls up, and like within 1 second or 2 seconds from when they get out, they shoot the kid.
Yeah.
So it's like the movie going on in that police officer's head. And again, like what's happening in his body in terms of body sensation and emotion and adrenaline. And like, so it's like shaping what he sees. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, he's got this unresolved trauma that is basically projecting out onto the world. And so then he's taking this little kid with a fake gun and turning it into like an adult with a real gun.
Yeah.
And so like, it's like his perception is literally like distorted.
Right.
The police officers. And so it's like, and then again, yeah, the overall training of, we need to get there as fast as we can and physically bring the guy down, as opposed to like, well, what if we just like maintain the distance and then slowly try to engage, and then the goal is like, to de-escalate the situation.
And I don't care what anybody says, that policeman is not sleeping well at night.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He may be lying to himself about it even, I don't know, but like, that is horribly traumatizing to know that you just killed a little kid on a playground.
Right.
Right. So it led to no good for anybody.
Yeah.
And maybe 6 months ago or so, a year ago now, took me a while to get through it. I watched the whole series run of Adam 12, which is this cop show that was on when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And so I decided to just watch it again. I'm like, I want to watch the show and see what this is like. Right.
Yeah.
Something really interesting happened just over the course of that show's couple, like 3 year run.
Mm-hmm.
The very first episode of that show. So it's these two main characters, an old veteran who's training this new young, you know, clueless cadet kid, you know what I mean? And that's the way it's set up. Right. Mm-hmm. And that veteran is about to retire because his partner just got killed and he thinks it's partially his fault. And he doesn't want to take responsibility for training up this kid. He doesn't think he's good enough, and that's kind of the setup.
Yeah.
But the key thing is that the show ends with a showdown, a gang shootout in a park, right? Where they all show up, and there's shotguns getting fired. It's a full-on, you know, shootout between these two gangs.
Yeah.
And they get out of their car, and it's the young cop kid immediately grabs his weapon, and the senior cop, like, stops him and says, just stay behind that tree.
Yeah.
And he never fires a weapon.
Yeah.
And he just runs from tree to tree and works his way up, right, until he gets into a situation where he can take out this one shooter. But it, like, his whole point is, you know, no guns. Like, we don't go in guns blazing.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what we do, right?
Yeah.
And that's a consistent motif over the beginning of the show. I was amazed at situation after situation after situation. They never, the cops never pull a weapon.
Yeah.
They run into gunfire because they're quote-unquote heroes, right? They're going to face a difficult situation, and they disarm it, and they get themselves in situations where they can talk people down, and they de-escalate, right? And they solve it. By the end of the series, it's all guns blazing.
Yeah.
So I actually think it's interesting that that series itself spans a shift in thinking about how we respond to those situations, right?
Yeah.
But in the beginning, the very clear message was, no, like, we get shot at, but we don't just automatically shoot back, right?
Right.
That's not our job, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's easy. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
But, and here's where I get a little bit sort of brutal. Like, if you want me to call you a hero, then that's what you better do.
Yeah.
Anybody can just pull out their own bigger weapon or even and start firing back. That is not heroic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and I have an issue around the use of that word a lot lately. Like, we're throwing it around a lot, you know, and I think we need to change that too, you know?
Yeah.
But de-escalation and finding better ways to solve that problem is better for everyone. If that situation is escalated, the cop doesn't have to go to bed at night and going, because I don't care what anybody says, you lay your head down at night going, did I really have to kill that guy?
Yeah.
You'll tell yourself you did because it's your only path towards, you know, getting any sleep.
Right.
But deep down, you're questioning, and it's not comfy, and it sucks.
Yeah.
And we do see that. That's why a lot of these times when it happens, like, police do just quit, you know? And it drives a lot of people out of the military, too. They're just like, I don't want to do this anymore, you know?
Yeah.
But now you don't want to do it anymore, but you're already carrying the guilt of some bad behavior.
Right.
And
yeah, then in Grossman's book, like, towards the end, he talks about, I mean, it's like a harsh example, but it kind of makes the point clear of, like, how atrocity is an addiction, that once you start that ball rolling, you can't stop it. It's like,
This is why one of the best books on this actually is Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. What you have to read the whole book.
Right.
What's interesting is this book gets used by both the extreme right and the extreme left as a justification for violence and violent revolution.
Yeah.
Right? Because no one reads the third part. Right? And in the third part, it's his record of being the psychiatrist for people from both sides of the conflict. Right?
Yeah.
And discussing how thoroughly and totally fucked up and permanently damaged they all are as a result of the revolutionary activity, regardless of which side they were on. That's the crucial part, and like, most people, you know, they leave that off, right? But it's a great text if you read the whole thing, because what he basically does is, like, what is the psychological toll of this?
Yeah.
Do you think you won this revolution? Like, did you really? You are completely dysfunctional as a human being. You're beating your kid, you know, your marriage is gone, you know, like really, what did you win? You know? Same thing for the people that were, even though on the losing side, the colonizers, but still, like, what did you ever gain? Was there real gain even while you were colonizing? Like, you were living in fear for years of your life. You know what I mean? You knew you were an oppressor. You knew you know what I mean? Like, he just totally rips the whole thing apart and just shows, like, there is no winner here.
Yeah.
You know, you do not, nobody wins a violent conflict.
Yeah.
You know, when both parties rise to the, you know what I mean, to the violence, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And so I think, yeah, it's like, it's so deeply ingrained in our society. The habit energy is so deep that these things are all just accepted as given, like truths. Like that's just how it is. So it's like the police training is like, oh yeah, like the situation is just violent. That's how it is.
Yeah.
So another thing that Grossman does, he's part of this, he trains, it's called the sheepdog movement or a sheepdog, whatever. So the idea is like mass shooting in a church. So he's training people like pastors and other people that are in churches, like how to have a gun in church and then be able to shoot someone that comes in.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. So.
What would Jesus do?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like, come on, man.
Yeah. So it's this like, okay. Yeah. Like obviously Jesus seemed like a pretty cool guy. I like Jesus, but this whole fundamentalist Christian, right? Tribalism mentality.
Survival at all cost, right?
Yeah. Like, that their transcendence is to be part of the tribe.
Yeah.
Part of a bigger group. And it's like, we're the group that survives because we've killed the other group. So that's their transcendence feel good project. And that's like, oh, this is just how the world is. This is just the fundamental reality. So I feel like that with Buddhism, with Hinduism, and like certain Christian mystics, it's like, okay, there has been this deep level of awakening where the most deep level given, where you think I am this body, this is who I am, that even that fundamental given that you think is just absolutely true and self-evident, that even that is shown to be not true, because when you do touch this deeper level of reality, this deeper ground of being, which that's Martin Luther King, his dissertation was on Paul Tillich and like seeing God as the ground of being.
Right.
When you're able to get in touch with this ground of being, even that level of what you thought was given is no longer.
It's no longer given. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I feel like that, yeah, our society, we've lost that, or we haven't yet developed that collective experience of this ground of being that can see these habit energies as just habit energies and not like fundamental truth realities.
Yeah, it's, I think that, again, to use the word we've used before, you know, I think addiction really is the right word here.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's what happens with addiction, right? Mm-hmm. You're so engulfed in that world that you can no longer see that it's not an accurate representation of reality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You believe the story in your head so mm-hmm. thoroughly. And I also think, like all addiction, one of the things that makes it so dangerous is that it really works for a while.
Yeah.
Right? Like for an alcoholic, you know, which I am, you know, mm-hmm. alcohol saved my life when I was 14, man. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I would have put a bullet in my head. Like I could not cope with my reality, you know, and that form of self-medicating really worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for it. I mean, I truly believe it saved my life when I was a young teen. Right. Mm. But what happens with an addiction is it stops working and you can't see that it's not no longer working.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you keep doing it because it's the only thing you know.
Yeah.
And you know that without it, you're fucked because you don't know there's an alternative, right?
Yeah.
So this gives you a really warped view of your reality. And that's why it's so hard to get out of addiction, because you have to take this kind of leap of faith that, like, you believe without this thing, I will die, man. Like, I cannot make it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about addiction, and addiction, people talk about a bottom, and for like alcoholism, it's totally true. What makes the bottom is the point where you get so miserable, you actually just don't care if you die.
Right.
You know, you're like, I'm so miserable that I just don't have the energy to care anymore. Like death is preferable to this. Right. So you get sort of forced into non-attachment.
Right, there's a transcendence there.
Yeah, and when that happens, you actually, then you can do without it. You're like, okay, I'm willing to accept. Like, how can it get more miserable? Like, if I die, I don't care. So, okay, fine. I'll try. 24 hours, I won't take a drink, and I'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I didn't die.
Yeah.
Pretty miserable, but I was pretty miserable before. I'll try another 24 hours. You know what I mean, right? Yeah. And that's kind of how it builds back up. So the question for us on the violence front is, like, you know, how far down do we have to go? How many people have to die? How miserable and traumatized do we all have to get before we finally realize, I'm so miserable anyway, I don't really care if I die. So maybe I'll try a nonviolent response to this situation and see how that works out.
Right.
Right? Because it seems to me that we are caught in an addictive way, and so we do have to bottom out. Like, I don't think as a society right now, anyway, the people who are in it are just going to, you know, have an awakening and decide to try a different way. Like, so what does that bottom look like? Right. You know, I don't know. I mean, and we talked about the sort of need to just teach mindfulness in general. Right. And maybe there's an idea that we could do that. Although it's not likely that people who are heavily addicted to violence are going to train their children that way.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know how real that necessarily is. You know, I don't know. I mean, there's other reasons why people would teach it, and maybe it can take root and work. But I think this is the problem, you know, that I do ask myself, like, what does our bottom look like?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when does it get bad enough that you just, that the people who are doing it are like, enough is enough. I just can't do this. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I cannot do this anymore.
Right.
That's the moment of change, right?
Yeah. And like, I mean, I kind of like try to, as like a thought experiment or just a way of trying to wrap my head around it, of like, and it's kind of dangerous even to, but I think of it as like kind of like three categories, like one category of people that are so addicted that if you try to help them out, they'll take it as an attack, you know? So the only thing you can do then is just containment, like just like create space around that person to where the amount of harm they can do is limited. And then, okay, then a group maybe that's like in the middle that is persuadable given the right conditions.
Well, before you go there, let's start with that first group.
Yeah.
Because what you need to do is contain the damage they can do to others while allowing them to continue to damage themselves.
Right.
That's the key to bottoming out, right?
Right.
Is that you have to, their level of suffering has to continue to increase, right?
You know? Right. Yeah.
So containment doesn't look like, you know, stick them in a pastoral setting in the Rockies somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's like stick them all on an island somewhere they continue to shoot at each other.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But stop damaging other people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like some like kind of wall around that.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
And then, okay, then a second group that is persuadable, and then a third group that's already willing and able.
Right.
But also, like, I think this is one of the key things is that even though you think you're willing and able to do this, when it actually gets down to doing the actual work, you're going to have a lot of stuff come up, and you shouldn't be surprised by that. Like, that's part of the process. Because I feel like that's one of the dangers is that there's this, like, one part of society that's just addicted to violence, and then another part that just has, like, kind of liberal ideas. So again, that I bring it back to the idea of like, if you're working with someone with trauma, if you just work on the level of conceptual thoughts and the narrative and you don't get into the deeper body and emotions, the transformation is not going to happen. So I feel like, people that are seeing themselves as progressive, willing and able, like we need to have some kind of psychoeducation process where like, okay, this is good. Good that your headspace is oriented in the right direction. Now, this actual process, what it's actually going to take, is going to be very difficult.
I think that is crucial.
Yeah.
And this is what leads to, you know, I think you and I have used this term together before, but you know, what I think of is like spiritual tourism.
Yeah.
People like they do a couple years in one kind of practice, and they, as soon as it gets, stuff starts to come out, it actually starts to bear fruit.
Yeah.
Which means it starts to get uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They go, oh, this isn't working. And yeah. they bolt to the next pink cloud where it can all be fresh and new. And they can, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they move from thing to thing. This is like Thomas Merton's thing about, you know, stick to your spiritual practice no matter how absurd it may be, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. it's this idea that we have been sold a bill of goods that we should be comfortable all of the time.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing, I say that hesitantly because the interesting thing is, as you know, once you get used to how this works, even extreme discomfort stops being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know what I mean? So there's this weird way in which you can be comfortable all the time
mm-hmm.
because discomfort is not so discomforting. I also have to describe that, right?
Right.
But you have to get to that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that means going through a few rounds of, oh shit, this is not fun right now, man. Like this is extremely not comfortable. This is where I think the Sangha is so important.
Yeah.
Because I hit this moment, you were there when I hit this moment at that protest in San Francisco with, you know, you and Caleb and, you know what I mean? Like a group of people from the Sangha.
Yeah.
Where I was just, everything in me just wanted to run.
Yeah.
Run, you know? And it was only because you guys were literally holding my hand, you know, and holding me up, that I was willing to sort of take the dive and go, okay, I'm gonna let this rush over me. I'm gonna actually have this experience right now.
Yeah.
And it was not a pleasant experience, the shit that was coming up. You know what I mean? Yeah. I could not have done that alone.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't think anybody can.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. You know what I mean? You get to where you kind of can, because ultimately you have to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
There comes a point in your practice where you have to go through those things, and it is, you know, God, the universe, the collective being, interbeing, whatever you want to call it, that is holding you up, right?
Yeah.
And you have to get there too, but that's an advanced practice.
Yeah.
Right. It has to start with the people around you, you know, but I do think we have to do a better job right out of the womb of letting people know that, like, the human ride is an uncomfortable ride sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You will learn to be okay with that discomfort. You'll actually learn to cherish it, you know, because you know you're on the verge of something really happening, like a really burning some karma here and transforming something that has been dogging you your whole life. You know, and so it becomes even pleasurable in this odd way, but in the beginning you have no analog for that. It just hurts and it sucks.
Yeah.
And we're so, that's so counter to what we're always being told our human experience should be.
Yeah.
You know, by frankly, I do, this is, it upsets me. Sometimes I hear certain people talk, you know, and all they ever talk about is just how freaking wonderful it is and great, and you know, and I go, like, you're lying.
Yeah.
You're not telling the whole story, and you're doing a disservice to people.
Yeah. You're addicted to the, what, like, you know, the biochemical response or the energetic response that happens by believing in that story.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, you're going to stall there, right? And
it
ain't going to work. And but again, the good news is that even discomfort stops being uncomfortable when you really cultivate mindfulness.
I remember I've only done two Goenka retreats because they're strict. Like, if you practice other practices besides theirs, they don't want you to keep doing their courses. But so I did two of them. And the second one I was in, actually is near 29 Palms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Speaking of the Marines.
Awesome. Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah, so it's this the Fastenal Center out there. I was there in the winter. And so it was a really cool course. And then after it was over, like if you wanted to volunteer to help kind of clean up and get the center cleaned up. So I was in the kitchen helping. And then they had a bulletin board, and there was this like paper that was up on the board, like maybe like a 4-page paper. And so I was okay. So I just, like started reading it. So it's Goenka. He's the teacher from India that was training in Burma with Uba Keen. And so his aunt, she got into doing the meditation. So she was doing like a month. She was doing like a 10-day retreat every month. And she was doing it for years and years. And then, so at one point she, was having some discomfort, some pain. So, you know, they went to the doctor and, long story short, they did some tests on her and found out that she was like in advanced stage, cancer, like I think maybe even like stomach cancer or something like that. And the doctor was like, well, this can't be true, because if you are at this stage, you would be in so much pain that you wouldn't even be able to sit up. You would just be like, yeah, like screaming or like, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And so they asked her, like, are you in pain? And she's like, oh yeah, I'm in an immense amount of pain. It's like worse than childbirth. But it's like, I've been practicing for so long just to be aware of sensation and let go of the reaction to it. Like I can just be with it. Like, it's like, I'm just being with it. So it's like, this is like a 70 or 80 year old woman going through this intense pain. And like, but because she'd put in this years and years of practice and she'd been around a community of people all doing it and was with a teacher who had reached like a deep level of realization, it's like, yeah, what's her capacity had gotten so developed. And so it's like, okay, like this is what's possible for humans to do. Like this is, it's a doable thing. But yeah, it's like, okay, you got to put in the work and do the training.
Yeah, exactly. You have to put in the work and do the training, right? You know, yeah. That's the bad news here, right?
Yeah.
You don't just get to have a mental realization and suddenly you're there.
Yeah.
It takes, you know, you have to practice.
Yeah.
Right. And if you want to have that benefit.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's not just benefit for you, it's benefit for everybody.
Yeah.
Right. That was just really important. I mean, a couple years into my practice, and I remember Fop Tree actually is the one, he said, Carl, you have to realize like you're not practicing for you.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what this is about. Right. You know, yeah. Like, because all the people you interact with in your day and all, you know what I mean? Like the impact is actually huge.
Yeah. 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 So it's like, it's mysterious. Like, yeah, just being alive, being in a body, having awareness, it's mysterious how there is interbeing. Cool. All right. Well, it seems
I think we
did what we were supposed to do.
Once again, yeah.
Cool. Okay, cool. So thanks a lot for being on the show again, and I'm sure this seems to be like a habit. We'll probably be talking again at some point. So
sounds good. Thank you.